Merħba għal program Minajnejn Barranin fejn jiena Colin Fitz niltaqa' u niddiskuti pajjiżna ma' diversi persuni ta' nazzjonalitajiet differenti li għal xi raġuni u oħra għamlu lil Malta id-dar tagħhom. Minajnejn Barranin fuq 103.7 campus jiena Colin Fitz illum għandi persuna oriġinarjament mill-Ingilterra li issa ilha tgħix Malta għal dawn l-aħħar 4 snin bejn wieħed u ieħor. Persuna illi waħda minn dawk il-barranin illi jiġu Malta jew ikollhom xi idea dwar Malta, forsi anke jsiru jħobbu l-Malta għal xi raġuni partikolari anke qabel jiġu hawnhekk. Mbagħad meta jiġu hawn jinnexxilhom jitlu fil-qasam ta' dak is-suġġett li jħobbu u jsiru jafuh dan is-suġġett u jagħmlu r-riċerka u jsiru esperti fuq xi suġġett partikolari illi jsiru jafu kważi aktar minn Maltin stess dwar dan is-suġġett. Jiġifieri naf persuna pereżempju mill-Olanda li spiċċa tgħix Malta u taf jew għandha kollezzjoni kbira dwar il-futbol Malti u taf ħafna dettalji dwar records dwar il-kampjonati tal-passat tal-futbol Malti. Illum ħan nitkellmu ma' persuna li probabilment jista' jitqies l-aktar espert magħruf jew l-akbar espert tal-famużi Malta buses, il-karozzi tal-linja, ix-xara bankijiet, ix-xara banks, ma' nafx inhu l-plural, il-karozzi tal-linja l-antiki ta' qabel l-arriva u mbagħad il-kumpanija li għandna issa. Jiġifieri qed ngħidu dawk il-karozzi ta' ħafna kuluri differenti, mbagħad saru ħodor, mbagħad saru sofor, dak li għandhom ċertu karattru u li jaffaxxinaw lil ħafna nies, speċjalment id-dilettanti ta' trasport u appuntu tal-karozzi tal-linja f'pajjiżi differenti u jeżistu eluf minn dawn jekk mhux miljuni anka fl-Amerika, madwar id-dinja kollha insomma. Forsi nisa u rġiel, forsi l-maġġoranza rġiel li baqgħu tfal li fitxu r-riċerka dwar il-ġugarelli tagħhom, forsi boys and their toys. Għalkemm kif dejjem ngħidu dejjem nisħaq ma jfissirx li m'hemmx nisa li huma interessati f'dawn is-suġġetti wkoll. Hello Richard and welcome to this program Malta Through International Eyes.
Hello. Good to see you again after all these years.
It's nice to see you again. I had interviewed you on a couple of my programs two or three years ago when I first started working here on Campus 103.7. I remember we were introduced by a mutual friend, Paul Gallia, Malta's foremost expert on the railway.
Yes.
The Malta Railway and the tramway. And he said, I'll introduce you to this fellow, this English fellow who is doing research and ended up working in the Malta archives about the Malta buses. But it turns out it's not just the buses, but much more than that. And we'll talk about that in a second.
Yep.
The kind of research you do later on in the program, because it's all about the people, really, isn't it? Rather
yes.
than the machines, although the machines do play an important part.
Yep.
But Richard, it's such a pleasure to have you. I was explaining to our listeners how you're one of those foreign people who fall in love with an aspect of Maltese culture, come here, move here, and then you become an expert and you end up knowing even more than most Maltese about a particular subject, which is very sweet, which is very nice. And that subject is the famous old Malta buses.
Yes, indeed.
You are probably a fan of all buses in general, but the Malta buses hold a special attraction, perhaps.
Yes, indeed. I'm reliably informed by my parents that pretty much the very first word I said as a baby in my pram was bus. Nobody's ever quite sure why, because there's no history in the family of anybody working in the bus industry. But yes, apparently when I was very small, out in the pram, a bus went past, and it was a bus, a bus. So I've always had an interest. When I was young, it was sort of very much the local area that I was living in, and as I got older, sort of my sort of geographical boundaries expanded.
Where in the UK where did you grow up in?
So I'm originally from the city of Rochester in Kent. Mm-hmm. Those listeners with a sort of interest in sort of naval history. Rochester is right next to Chatham, which was obviously one of the big Royal Navy dockyards for many, many years. But I'm originally from Rochester. I've been living here now for 7 years, but I had been sort of visiting for many, many years before that. My first visit here was around about April 1987, just before my 15th birthday.
Gosh.
Traditionally, family holidays were always in the UK. But in the mid-80s, my parents decided, let's try, one of these sort of overseas package holidays. And in 86, we went to Crete. And then in 87, we did a short stay of only about sort of 4 or 5 nights here in Malta, staying in the Maliha Bay Hotel, which has obviously now been demolished and the site's being redeveloped. And at the time, the old classic Malta buses weren't actually all that interested to me.
Oh.
I just didn't know anything about them.
They were green at the time.
Everything was light green for the local buses on the main island, and then grey with a red band on the
Gozo.
But what there were growing number of back in the mid-80s were buses and coaches that had come from the UK to help replace around about a third of the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And those were of interest to me.
And they were slightly bigger, and they were... Yeah. Okay. But let's just establish this for our listeners, because perhaps not everybody knows. The old Malta buses with all the chrome and that are now used for weddings or souvenirs or whatever, those buses were... The chassis... was an English or American truck.
Often, yes.
Often. And then the Maltese bus designers would build a wooden bus body over the truck and engine, over the chassis and engine.
Yeah, the frames originally would have been wooden.
Yes.
And then obviously it would have been a metal sort of outer skin type.
Yeah.
But as time went on, the framing switched to... a hybrid of wood with sort of metal around it.
Okay.
And eventually it was just steel frames because they were a lot stronger and therefore the bodies lasted longer.
And that's what makes them unique to any other country, because they were built here and designed here, and then the Maltese designers and bodybuilders, as we call them, not bodybuilders as in fitness, but bodybuilders, the Maltese word would be tillar, perhaps. The people who repair bodywork on cars, they would then stick on, for example, the rear lights from a car and the front lamps and some chrome work, and then they decorate them with all sorts of individual decorations. So that's what makes the Maltese buses fascinating. You were talking about those buses that started to come to Malta in the 80s, which the Maltese would call privates, and they were more like coaches, and those weren't built here.
No.
And they were sort of bought secondhand from the UK. Maltese people called them London buses.
That's right, partly because the first big batch that came over late 89, early 81, were indeed from London.
Indeed.
But what tended to happen was... anything that was a bus that came from the UK got referred to as a London bus.
We're talking about those flat-fronted ones, the ones with the very flat front. While the ones, the original Malta buses, they look a bit like a vintage car in some ways. Your interest in buses, just to let our listeners know as well, has led you to an employment here in Malta. You work for the Malta Archives on the Memoria project.
Correct. So I head up the Malta Bus Archive project, which, as you say, is part of the larger Memoria project, which national archives around the world traditionally have been very good down the years at preserving official state history, official documentation, all that sort of thing. What a lot of national archives are now doing is they're seeing the importance of preserving sort of more personal history. So, sort of collections of photographs, cine film, diaries,
logbooks,
all that sort of thing. And, what we've done here in Malta is, up until now, we've kind of sort of looked at some specific sort of industrial jobs and areas and things, and the bus industry is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I specialise in the bus industry. But as you said earlier, it's not just the vehicles. Whilst the vehicles are fascinating and unique, and it's what people instantly, you know, you say Malta bus, and there are people over a certain age on this island, they will think of the classic Maltese bus and that sort of thing. But it is about the people.
And in the world, not just in Malta. There are people around the world who know and who mourned the end of the Malta buses. I even was in London, and I see on the front cover of a bus magazine, a bus collectors or bus enthusiast magazine, the end of the Malta bus, and it was Malta on the front cover. I was in a railway station, and there was a news agent. And, oh, hello. So there's a massive interest.
Yeah, back in July 2011 when everything changed. There must have been 50 or 60 people at least over from the UK. I was one of them to come over.
Yeah. But you were talking about, not just the buses and the machines, but... Yeah.
But the people as well. So part of my job is to go out and talk to either those people who have worked themselves in the bus industry as owners, drivers, conductors, bus builders, people who, you know, we even talked to one guy who was a traffic police officer on a motorbike, and one of his jobs would be each day to, I think it was mostly in the Lua area, he would, you know, kind of sort of monitor the buses and make sure not only were they running to time, but the drivers and conductors were wearing their correct uniform and that, you know, things were being done as per the rules. So it's a whole host of people we talk to, and then also for those who are sadly no longer with us, we've been talking to their sons and daughters or even grandchildren about stories they remember being told. Sadly there are no longer any drivers alive who were driving during the Second World War. It's just that too long a period now. If I'd been able to start this 10 years earlier, we would still been able to...
What memories you would have been able to jot down on paper, right?
Indeed, yes.
Or on a computer.
So, but what we've been able to do is talk to some people who, you know, their fathers were or their uncles were drivers during the war. And some of the stories that they were told, you know, there was one guy, he told me his father had driven the bus from Zeytun across towards the dockyard. And as he came, luckily he hadn't got anybody on board at the time. He was going over to take dockyard workers back toward Zeytun. And as he came out of one of the bastion walls near the dockyard,
the tunnels,
a German plane flew over. Fired at the bus, and he kind of sort of pulled over and said to himself, I think the bus has been hit. And no more than probably sort of 5 or 10 centimetres above his head was a bullet hole.
Oh, my goodness.
So he came that close to losing his head, basically.
Wow.
And it's stories like that that really... It's that personal... Yes.
That's less than 100 years ago, we're talking, and happened to one of us. Yeah.
So, and we're looking for things that don't appear in the official documentation.
Indeed. Now, I don't want to make this a whole program about buses,
but
it's what you do. But it's about, I want to talk to you about stuff.
Yep.
But it's important to frame to frame things because that's your job, that's your career, what you do. And I'm just passing the information on to our listeners. How, for example, nowadays there's a bus company and drivers, some foreign, lots of international drivers, but also Maltese drivers. They work for the company and there's a bus timetable. But in the old days, there were individual bus owners or small companies with two or three buses. It was sometimes a family affair. And there was some sort of cooperative and the routes were agreed in a very different way to how they are now. So there are all these aspects that need to be put down as historic elements so that they can be preserved and studied in the future.
That's just it. You know, very much the way I look at the work that I am doing is so that it's recording the information whilst there are still people around who remember, whilst documents and photographs still exist, so that they are there for future reference. You know, I don't do any of it for, you know, my own glory or anything. Mm-hmm. My view is it's getting stuff done so that it's then there for the future generations.
The most interesting story out of many stories you've heard, apart from the one you told us with the bus that got machine gunned by a German plane, another maybe story from a veteran of the Malta bus scene or the sons and daughters or grandchildren of someone?
Yep, certainly. Well,
and we're talking about Gozo as well. You're even writing a book about the scene in Gozo.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spring next year is the 100th anniversary of the very first motor buses starting to operate on Gozo.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been spending much of this year interviewing people and gathering information, gathering photographs to go into what's going to be, you know, the definitive book on Gozo's bus industry. Again, not just the vehicles, but the people. And the intention is to launch that spring next year, and we'll have an event over on Gozo.
Fantastic.
But you said about a story and things. It's amazing how sort of multi-generational, you know, the industry can be. There's a family over on Gozo, known by the nickname Takelis, the Caruana family, who have been in the industry for at least four generations now. Mm. So from, you know, one of the very first owners and drivers on the island, you know, kind of sort of started back in, I mean, the earliest mention I've got for him at the moment is 1926, so about a year after things started. But his father was originally a horse-drawn cab driver. Mm. And there's a suggestion that probably it goes back even further than that. But sadly, the family members I've spoken to, they just don't have that knowledge and those records going
back. Of how far back it goes. The transport the career in their family.
But it's if you look at the wider field of not just buses, but transport as a whole, it's at least now five generations.
Because there used to be buses, horse-drawn, but like carriages, but they didn't just carry two or three or four people, but a number of people, 10 people, for example.
Yeah, omnibuses, I think they call them. That's just it, the horse-drawn omnibuses. I've not found yet any evidence of those running on Gozo.
On Gozo. But they were in Malta.
Various places from about the 1860s onwards on Malta. But if anybody listening does know of anybody evidence or does know of anybody who you know, worked with horse-drawn omnibuses on Gozo, please let me know as soon as possible, because I can then make a mention of that in the book.
In the book, absolutely.
Everything's finalised.
So how can they contact you? Facebook?
Facebook. There's a Malta Bus Archive Facebook page, and also an email address, maltabusarchive, all as one word, @gmail.com.
And you also have a page on YouTube?
Yes.
Malta Bus Archive.
There's Malta Bus Archive on YouTube, where if you really want to, you can listen to all the interviews we did about 3 years ago, and I've put a whole load of sort of PowerPoint slides to go with those.
Absolutely, yes. So you can hear my voice and Richard's talking about basically the whole history of the buses in Malta and Gozo. So Gozo buses, motor buses, started around 1925. In Malta?
Malta, the earliest bus arrived, a demonstrator arrived December 1904.
Around the same time as the first car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A very small operation started September, October time 1905. But by the end of 1906, that had finished. Mm. The roads were just too poor state, competition across the harbour from Sleema with the boats and everything. And it was then 1920 before things restarted.
The buses. And so then the buses led to the end of the railway pretty much, because then they pretty much took over, didn't they?
That's just it.
Yeah.
When you know, 1920, by the end of 1920, there were maybe, I don't know, a dozen, maybe 20 buses running on Malta. by the end of 1930, there were something like 550
Gosh,
running just on Malta.
This is such a fascinating subject, but we need to talk about your experience in Malta. This is Minainen Barani, Malta through international eyes. And I want to talk also about how the Maltese see you as this foreigner who's come here asking all these questions.
Yep.
That's some interesting encounters. But let's play our first bit of music out of two that I ask my guests to prepare.
I've chosen two very different pieces of music, mm-hmm. but both with sort of what to me, one way or another, say the UK and Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So the first piece is a piece by Queen. I'm a huge Queen fan, always have been. You know, the late, great Freddie Mercury, the things he could do with his voice, both high and low notes and things, was absolutely amazing. I've chosen one of their sort of slightly later pieces of music, and that's The Show Must Go On, partly because I sadly lost my sister when she was only 30 years old, and from that point onwards, my philosophy in life is, whatever happens, the show must go on. None of us know how long we're on this earth for. Make the most of every opportunity that comes along.
That's beautiful. Let's hear The Show Must Go On by Queen, as chosen by Richard Steadall.
Empty spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know the score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime. Behind the curtain, in the pantomime. Hold the line, does anybody want to take it anymore?
Thank you. with that beautiful Queen song, Richard. Great choice. Let's go back to 1987. You were here on holiday with your family.
Indeed.
And the buses, the Malta buses didn't really affect you, but you started noticing the so-called London buses.
That's just it. You know, it was that's kind of sort of what started off my interest. By the end of the 5 days that we were here, I'd had a chance to ride on a couple of the classic buses and things and thought, these are different. But what are they? And once I got back to the UK, through a couple of groups that exist for bus enthusiasts, one called Buses Worldwide and one called the PSV Circle, they both published lists of all the known vehicles that were operating on Malta at the time. So I got hold of both of their lists and started sort of going down and sort of looking at some of the history of it and what some of these vehicles actually were. And I was thinking, that's interesting.
And you were already a bus enthusiast.
I was highly into buses, at age 15. But, you know, not so much overseas. You know, it was mostly, even at that stage in the UK, it was mostly still London and the South East. Okay. I hadn't started travelling around the UK much at that point.
But working here in Malta for the Malta Archives, is this the only time in your career, because I believe in the UK, the bus thing was a hobby.
Yes.
And you worked as a weatherman, I believe.
Yeah.
But here in Malta, you're actually working on your hobby. Your hobby and your work are the same thing.
Yes.
Is this the only country in the world that you've done that? Because I know you've visited many countries chasing buses and things as well. But has Malta been the country that has given you a job that you can live out your fantasies pretty much?
Yes, to a certain extent. You know, it's the only, you know, living and working here is the only time I've ever lived and worked outside of the UK. As you say, I've travelled around the world a lot, taking photographs, making notes and
visiting bus conventions.
That's it. You know, I've done a lot. I've got friends all around the world. And obviously these days with, you know, sort of modern online communications and things, I can talk to, you know, I've got friends in Fiji and Samoa in the South Pacific. I can talk to them as easily as I'm talking to you now.
Absolutely, yeah.
But thanks to the likes of, you know, sort of Zoom and Facebook and all that sort of thing. But yeah, Malta's always been special. And once I kind of sort of fell in love with the buses, really, you know, because of the way that the industry's been structured over here, because up until 2011 there wasn't a single official state-run company or anything like that, there's never really been any preservation of records and information. So to a certain extent, I've got to go out and pull it all together from various sources. Now, luckily,
so records were kept, but they'd be at the police headquarters or what is now Transport Malta, or individual families would have them, but there wasn't a central place.
There wasn't a coordinated sort of central. It wasn't as if, you know, there was a company, ABC Buses, who, you know, had got 70 years' worth of records to do with their company and bits and pieces. There was none of that. So, and sadly, you know, down the years, various sets of records don't appear to have survived. For example, the traffic section of the police would have once had lists of all the drivers, all the conductors, and the drivers and conductors used to have on their caps that they would wear a badge with a number on it, so that anybody knew, you know, that was driver 1234 type thing, and therefore they'd know from the records who that was. So all those records that listed, you know, the badge numbers and who the people were, none of that survived.
By the way, bus conductors stopped in the 80s, I think, in Malta, early 80s.
1979.
Oh, 79. I was a child. I still remember them myself, but I was very young, so 79 were...
Yeah, it was about 79, it was, that they finally stopped.
Let's go back then to 1987. Apart from the buses.
Yes.
What were your impressions of Malta in those 5 days when you first came here? You were about 15.
I was just coming up for 15. I don't remember much about it. We kind of sort of stayed around the hotel a fair bit because we were only there for sort of four or five nights. Mm-hmm. So by the time we'd flown out and flew back, we only had about three or four full days.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the fact that we had sort of early hours of one morning, a rather spectacular thunderstorm.
Oh, gosh. Must have been August.
But no, it was April time. And it was so, yeah, you know, just that period where you're starting to get the warm air mixing with cold air and you fire off the spring.
That's your weatherman background.
That's my weatherman hat on tight hangs.
Yes.
But I don't remember huge amount. Obviously, there was the history. I remember it being obviously a lot warmer than it was back in the UK things. But on that particular visit, there wasn't anything much that kind of sort of made me think, oh, I really must come back here.
Okay.
However, 5 years later, I was 20. I'd been working for 18 months, 2 years sort of full-time by then. And I thought to myself, I want to do my first overseas holiday on my own, without the family and things. And I thought, well, where shall I go? Let's go back to Malta. As I said, I'd been doing, knew a little bit more about the buses and things, and I thought, well, at least I know where Malta is. I even went back and stayed at the same hotel again. It wasn't the cheapest by any means on the island, but the important thing was, you've got to remember, I was only 20 at the time. I knew where it was. I knew what I was going to get at the hotel. So I thought, now that'll do. And the intention was I was going to come for 10 days or so on my own. But a colleague of mine at work had had a nasty accident. He'd been knocked off his bicycle by a van, which didn't stop, and badly injured all the tendons in the back of his knee and everything. And he was off work for 6 months. And towards the end of that, he kind of was getting ready to go back to work, but he was feeling quite sort of depressed and things. So I said, well, look, come to Malta with me. We'll actually do the tourist thing. But I said, you've got to allow me some time to do the buses as well. And it's the only time I've ever been to Malta and Gozo, where most of the time went out and about. Yeah, we went to the museums, we did a around the island cruise, we went to Camino, you know, and it was all these things that, you know, that as a tourist a lot of people do. But you know, I've never done the tourist thing wherever I've gone, type thing. So
it's mostly the buses.
Exactly. Yeah. That comes first. If there's time to do some tourist side of things, then yeah, you know. So that was an interesting trip. That was spring 92. And I really sort of was, you know, sort of got bitten by the bug then. And then from 96 onwards...
And by that time, did you start to make any Maltese friends? And
not so much then. It was from about 2002 onwards, I started coming every year in the spring, bringing an ever-growing party of British bus enthusiasts.
Okay.
Started off with just two or three friends, and by the time we got to about 2010, there was about 40 of us. And I kind of slowly but surely got introduced to some local sort of transport enthusiasts, and they started coming along on my trips. And that was therefore why, when I moved here 7 years ago, I already had a group of friends here that I knew, that I'd been in touch with for many years and things. So it wasn't as if I was moving somewhere where it was a complete fresh start. I knew nobody, I knew nothing about.
How did people react to you being so interested in all these buses, whether they were drivers or whether they were transport officials, or how did you build up your friendships here in Malta?
Well, luckily, there had been people who were interested in the buses. Coming in ever-creasing numbers from the 70s onwards, as package tours came on the market, as flights became a lot cheaper and things, more and more people. So to a certain extent, and even then, even sort of just general tourists, even today, you know, you show them a picture, show them an old bus, and everyone wants to take a picture.
Yes.
Well, even at the time, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, exactly the same thing. A lot of tourists, it's a proper old Malta bus, take a picture. So from that side of things, people who worked in the industry were used to it.
Okay.
Because also there were enthusiasts coming over and things. I wasn't the only one who would maybe strike up a conversation with a driver or an owner or somebody. And therefore, yeah, again, it's not as if I was the first person they'd ever come across.
Mm-hmm.
In all the years I've been doing this, it has been extremely rare to find a driver or owner who's got upset at the idea of me taking a photograph of their vehicle. I never do it if the vehicle's inside a garage or on a private piece of land. I always seek permission first.
Of course, of course.
Because, you know, you wouldn't like it if somebody walked into your garage and suddenly started taking pictures of things.
Absolutely.
And things. But if it's out on the open road, if it's in service and things, you know, the law states, you know, it's fair game. Mm-hmm. Anybody can take a photograph of anything out on the public road.
Have you found yourself being adopted by some of these families that you've gone to interview? And
yes. You know, after I'd been here a couple of years, there was a couple of old people I was sort of talking to, and as with usual, you know, kind of the odd comment had come out from them, not in a nasty way, but just sort of commenting about how the fact that there are a lot more people from overseas now living and working in Malta, and I kind of sort of put my hand up and said, "Yeah, well, I said, well, hang on a minute," I said, "I'm an." immigrant to your country, you know, I'm not Maltese," and there was this sort of wave of a hand as if to say, and the comment
you're
came
different.
Back, "Yeah, yeah, you're,
you don't
we,
count.
We see you as an honorary Maltese, especially because of the work that I've been doing, because I've been taking a strong interest in Maltese culture and history. You know, there are people who, you know, they don't see me necessarily as this mad Englishman." You know, they see me as part of the community and things here. And that's one of the things I really like about the island, is the fact that it is rare to find people who, once you get talking to them, aren't friendly, you know, and don't want help and things. Most people I've come across, you know, you've almost, you know, sort of new best friend type thing. So.
Yeah. Richard, so this is Minai Nain Baranin, Malta's Through International Eyes. Richard Steddall, who's British, originally from Rochester, has been in Malta 7 years, being interviewed by me, Colin Fitz. Let's hear another song, another piece of music, the second one you've chosen that represents you or where you're from.
Okay, this is going to be something probably from the point of view of your listeners, very different. Some of them might have heard of this group, and that's the Ukulele. Oh, put my teeth back in again. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. Now, they've actually been going for several decades now. They're an ensemble group, and as the name suggests, they only play ukuleles. When you see them on stage, they're very formally dressed in, you know, the men in dinner jackets with bow ties things, and the women formally dressed as well. And you think it's going to be a very serious concert. And they've got the best sense, British sense of humour going, and it's very light-hearted. And they will play and sing a huge variety of songs. A lot of it is covers. And what they also do brilliantly is they take maybe 5 or 6 songs. Each
famous
member
songs
of the group will start singing a bit of that particular song, and then they sing it with somebody else singing it. And before you know it, you've got 5 or 6 different songs being played all at once. And it sounds so natural. You'd think that's how it was originally been written and things. They've done a few different ones like this, but this one's called Fly Me Off the Handle. And the premise is the fact that it starts with just a short phrase of music from the classical composer Handel being played on one of the ukuleles. And George Hinchcliffe, who's one of the co-founders of the group many years ago, he says, as his part of the, sort of the introduction, the fact that you know, this piece of music has been very influential down the years to so many composers and songwriters. And then that's the premise, the fact that it then leads into all these different... And by the end of the song, as I say, you've got 6, 7 different pieces of music all being sung and played. and then all of a sudden that stops and it just finishes off with that short little melody from Handel again. And it really, I would love them to come to Malta and do a concert. I think they would be really, really popular. So if there are any concert promoters out there listening, that's my tip. You need to get the ukulele orchestra going. But they tour all around the world, America, Germany, Australia. So they've got lots and lots of international fans, and I think the Maltese audience would love them to bits.
The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain.
Yeah, fly me off the handle.
Fly me to the moon and let me swing amongst those stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter or Mars. In other words, hold me close. In other words, darlings, kiss me. Where do I begin? The great love story that is older than the sea. The great love story that belongs to you and me. Dum dum dee doo doo dum dee dum dee dee. Where do I start?
The autumn leaves drift by my window. The autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your face, the summer kisses, sunburned hands I used to hold.
Strumming my fate with his fingers and telling my life with his words. Killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song. On a dark desert highway,
by my side, and then I spent so many nights just thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along, and so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you there with that sad look upon your face. I should have made you leave your key, I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second you'd be back to bother me, go on now, go. Walk out the door, just turn around now, 'cause you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? Do you think I'd crumble? Do you think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, no, no.
Where do I begin? It's the great love story that is older than the
sea. I know I'll stay
alive.
I've got all my life to live, but I've got all my love to give.
Rising up to the end, like a kiss on the dress.
Fly Me Off the Handle by the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. Absolutely crazy, but fantastic. Fun stuff. Yes, I'd love to see them live as well, perhaps even here in Malta. That would be great.
If you've got YouTube, they have actually uploaded lots and lots of their songs onto their official YouTube channel. Mm. So I highly recommend going and having a look at some of that as well.
And if you're on YouTube, you can also check out Richard's YouTube channel, which is called the
Malta Bus Archive.
Yeah.
And there's various videos on there to do with the bus industry and history here in Malta.
British food, your favourite British food, something you'd recommend to... in Malta, we have this running joke about comparing Italy and England or the UK and how British food is not so compared to Italian food. But tell us something delicious from the UK that you would recommend.
Well, the one thing that I miss the most is a proper British fish and chip meal, or in my case, sausage and chips.
Mm.
With lashings of salt and malt vinegar on and things. Yes, you can get that sort of thing here, but it's just not the same.
Not the same. Even the type of fish, I assume.
The fish is different, but even the way the chips are cooked is different. And the fact that in the UK they tend to be quite bigger, chunky chips, whereas traditional in the Mediterranean it's much sort of thinner. Chips and things. So yeah, that's probably what I miss the most. But when it comes to sort of local dishes,
yes, Maltese food.
I'm not a fan on octopus. I'm not really a fan on rabbit, but I do like the local dish bracioli.
Bracioli, okay.
A friend of mine introduced it to me a few years ago. I've tried it in various places on the island. And everywhere seems to do it slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a place in Rabat, just along the end of the road where I live, that is probably my favourite. And, yeah, if I take people, if I've got visitors staying with me, or even if they're just meeting up in the evening for a meal, I tend to sort of take them somewhere like that.
There's a narrow street that ends with the Pastizzi place.
Yes.
That tends to have some very good restaurants along it.
Yes.
It's probably one of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I would, as you say, there's a number of places along that road. I would recommend any of them, to be honest.
Yes, great experience, absolutely. Yeah. Happened to be there a few days ago, actually, and I was just noticing what an amazing selection there is. And it's also a very picturesque, pretty street.
It is, and to be honest, I've now lived in Rabat 3.5 years of my 7 I've lived here. And I would be quite happy to live there the rest of my life. Living in one of the little narrow streets, hardly any cars, and it's just so nice. I would, I'd happily live, I suppose, actually in any of the villages in the old cores.
Mm.
Again, that's one of the things I like is especially sort of maybe later in the afternoon or in the early evening when it's quiet and down, a bit cooled down a little bit.
Yeah.
Just to sort of stroll around some of these old village cores, even kind of sort of big bustling places like Burkakara.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a map and you suddenly realise that how much of the old village core still exists just off those main roads.
Mm-hmm.
I love sort of looking around at some of the old buildings and things. So
that's do you get by on the buses or do you drive?
I can drive, I don't drive.
So I
purely by bus, unless, for example, if I'm working over on Gozo, I need to be into Victoria by 8 in the morning. I can't physically do that from Rabat in time to catch the 6:45 ferry.
Mm.
So in that case, I'll catch a cab.
Mm. But you find yourself travelling around Malta generally by bus or by cab,
by bus,
and it's okay. You mind you do work in the same village as the place you live in.
Yes. These days, most of my working days are a 6-7 minute stroll each way across the city.
So you don't really have to commute that much.
No, luckily.
But you can do without a car.
Yeah.
Okay, another question I ask all my guests, Maltese, in these 7 years, have you felt the need to learn Maltese? Are you interested in learning it?
Oh, now there's the $64 million question. I am hopeless with learning. You know, even when I was at school and I had 5 years compulsory of learning French, it was a struggle. And also my brain, you know, I often on my walk to work in the morning, I see the same, primarily little old ladies, but sometimes little old men as well. And as I approach them, I always think to myself, say bonjour, say bonjour, say bonjour. I open my mouth and what comes out, good morning. And I then walk away going, why did I say that? But, you know, it's just brain and mouth are rarely. I laugh and joke the fact that there were times when I struggled to speak English, let alone any other. But okay. what I have said to myself is that once this project with the Gozo 100 book and event is done and out of the way in spring next year, I really must, even if it's just sort of conversational Maltese, find myself a language tutor or at least someone daft enough to try and teach me some Maltese and just learn some of the common phrases and things. Not that I would necessarily be able to have a long, detailed conversation with somebody in Maltese, but at least, you know, understand a little bit about the language. It's not one of the easiest ones to learn in the world, but I feel as though I should really make an effort.
Some people feel that Britain and Malta have always had, at least since the connection between Malta and Britain started, there's a sort of special relationship between Malta and the UK. Do you feel that way? Do you still think there are close ties between the two countries?
Obviously, because I've only lived here 7 years and been a regular visitor for, say, the last 20, 25 years, that's the only time period I can really comment about. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm aware from, obviously, with my historian's hat on, that especially during the 20th century, things tended to sort of flip-flop. Mm-hmm. You know, there were those parts of the population who were very pro-British, mm-hmm. and would have been quite happy for, you know, the British to stay. There were those who were very much anti-British and were very pleased, especially during the 70s, to see the back of the British military from the island and things. But what I can certainly say is, you know, sort of in more modern days, more modern times, that my personal feeling is the fact that, yes, there is a bit of a special relationship there. There are those who are, you know, still not, maybe not anti-British, but they're not necessarily pro-British. Mm-hmm. There are those who comment on whether the George Cross should be on the flag, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I think there is that connection. And to be honest, the British colonial power was here for the best part of, what was it, 150 years
something
or so.
Like that, yeah.
And therefore, you know, that will leave. You know, there are still close ties between Britain and India. Mm. There are even still close ties between Britain and Ireland. And, you know, that's probably one of the most political, you know, kind of sort of differences between the two. But in the end, most Brits and most Irish still get on with each other. Mm. And, you know, you've only got to look at the number of British people who come here for holidays. Mm. You've only got to look at the number of Maltese people who go to the UK for holidays or who have family there or one thing or another. I think what we have these days is a fairly healthy, modern 21st century relationship between the two countries.
It's been delightful chatting with you. You have visited how many countries in the world chasing buses?
Oh, God.
At least, yeah. Was it 50, 60?
Maybe not quite that many, but geographically, the geographical spread around the world is enormous. You know, as I said, I've been to the South Pacific.
Little islands and obscure islands.
I do have this thing for, which is probably why I like Malta so much. Yeah. I do have this thing for smaller islands and go into places that not necessarily people frequently go to. So, for example, a few years ago, I went to Norway. Mm-hmm. But I went to the very far north of Norway, mm-hmm. where you know you get far fewer, certainly British visitors going. I did some work a number of years ago for the big international charity Oxfam, mm-hmm. and they arranged for me to go to Niger, part of what was once sort of French Africa, to go and see some of their work. That's 11, 12 years ago now. That was fascinating to see not just the work that, you know, the charity does, but from a cultural point of view of, you know, what it was like to try and live in such a poor part of Africa that really does, you know, you think the fact that, you know, Malta doesn't get much rain a year. Niger, well, if you look at the overall total, it's quite high, but it's because they'll get a month where they'll maybe get some really torrential thunderstorms. And then the remaining 11 months of the year,
nothing.
Temperatures even higher than here and things. But yeah, I like when I do sort of travel around the world going on the buses to sit at the back of a bus,
yeah,
and people watch. And just, you know, who are the people that are getting on and off the buses? Where are they, you know, yeah, where are they going? If they've been shopping, you know, what sort of... You know, I was in Indonesia once. I was actually on a train, a little local train rather than a bus, and all of a sudden you could hear goats bleating because the people who got on the back of the bus, the back of the train, with about three or four goats and things.
So you've visited many countries around the world, lots of little islands. You've chased buses, you've people watched, you've interacted with people, you've even done some charity work. And yet Malta is the place that you settled in apart from your home country of the UK.
Yeah.
So it's been a pleasure to have you here on this show.
And it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for all the work you do, cataloguing and writing down, putting down on paper and on recordings, the history of transport in Malta, Richard Steddle. We'll remind our listeners one last time of your website, and perhaps anybody who would like to get in touch with you to give you information about the history of buses in Malta.
Okay, and so Gozo. There are three main options for you. First of all, there's the email address, Malta Bus Archive, all as one word, @gmail.com. There is a Malta Bus Archive Facebook page, and you can go onto that and ask questions, and I will do my best to try and answer them for you. And there's also a Malta Bus Archive YouTube channel, and you can find some educational videos there. And when I came to talk to you a number of times about 3 years ago...
on campus radio,
that's just it. What we then did was put a recording, a copy of the recording of those interviews, and I added to them some photographs and charts and things, so to help sort of visualise what we'd been talking about.
We pretty much went through the entire history of buses in the Maltese Islands in a series of interviews a few years ago. You can also be contacted at the National Archives in Rabat, which is where you work, and it's been a pleasure having you on this edition of Malta Through International Eyes, Minainain Baranin on Campus 103.7. Thank you.
Thank you.